Good evening. Welcome to the Clear University Higher Education in 2020 virtual town hall. I'm John King. I'm news director at WHMI Radio in Howell. I'll be your moderator for the evening. I'm joined by an esteemed panel of Clear University faculty and officers. We're going to be delving into a variety of issues surrounding the future of higher education, both specifically at Clear University, as well as among academic institutions in general. I have a list of questions and topics that we're going to be discussing tonight, but I highly encourage members of the public to please ask any questions of their own. Please put those into the chat function on your screen if you want to enter any questions in there, and we will get to those very soon. Our panelists for the evening include Dr. Emily Barnes, who is Clery's interim president and provost. Mm-hmm. Dr. Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President of Institutional Advancement. Heather Bateman, the Vice President and Dean of Student Affairs. Dr. Regina Banks Hall, the Dean of Graduate and Professional Studies. And David Hayes, the Dean of Undergraduate Studies. Now, before we get to our discussion, I'd like to turn the floor over to Dr. Barnes for some opening remarks. Dr. Barnes.
Thanks, John. So I was reflecting on what I wanted to say to open this evening, and I was looking through several publications and the media and news headlines, and lately what I see in the media is these headlines collectively calling attending college this year a life or death situation. There's a lot of drama attached to it, a lot of fear attached to even the way things are worded, and I think about the subtitles or the one-liners that are calling reopening for the fall a challenge unlike any college leader has ever faced before. So I was reading this week's issue of the Chronicle, and that's what they called it. It was a challenge unlike any a college leader has ever faced before. And then I couldn't help but think about what a college president of the past might say about that statement when they describe what it was like to open their universities during times of war or during times when immigrants fled their country of massacre to come to the U.S. or what it may have been like or how they may argue of what it was like to open college during the Spanish flu or the bubonic plague, for instance, multiple famines and war after war after war and what that was like. And then I thought about how hard it must have been to run the Tuskegee Institute in 1906. For example, or running a college president or a college campus during the Great Depression. Things that are not, right, or today would not be considered more or less challenging than what we're going to face this fall. And I do believe that the past has a way of teaching us about the present and giving us perspectives about the present. And I have found myself in a whirlwind of sometimes seeing only the risk factors or the negativity that surrounds this year, but it's still a new year of college. It's still a new year to start new things, new adventures, new quests for many people, new paths that they are seeking for the first time, something that they're trying to do for themselves in a place that they call home and where they find comfort during a time like this one. And I think about our task this year is not the greatest challenge that we have met yet, nor will it be in the future. And I think that this year we have many obstacles that we get to overcome and we get to innovate through to find a new normal. And I think that with all the people on this call and with our community, that together, not only are we going to thrive or survive this new normal, we'll thrive in this new normal, and then we'll be able to create a new normal that we are now existing in, something that we've sculpted ourselves. And I think that this year, while it is challenging, right, it's new to all of us, it's a landscape we have never navigated through before. It is a unique opportunity to innovate and to take the veil off of what we've been avoiding and see the things that we must overcome and we must tackle now so that we can be sustainable for the next 100 years. And I'm looking forward to this discussion. I'm looking forward to being part of this discussion. I think it's very meaningful. And I want to thank everybody for being here. But I did want to, I wanted to start the day with perspective, because it's easy to spiral into the headlines and what we see every day, all day. And I just wanted to think about how to start this discussion today. And I wanted to think about the past as we move into our new future. So thank you. Thank you for having us.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate what you're saying. And, you know, very well said in terms of the fact that times of upheaval and disruption, economic and otherwise, are certainly not new to this nation. Mm-hmm. We've certainly reacted to those in various ways. Education, just one sector that has had to adapt as times have changed. But specific to the age that we're in now, the time that we're in now, and looking towards the end of summer and into fall, I think most folks, when it comes to higher education, are wondering exactly how, especially with things being so fluid, there are no settled norms right now, but looking out towards reopening in the age of COVID. How does an institution, an academic or otherwise, especially one that has a residential component, dormitories and otherwise, mm-hmm. How do you reopen in the age of COVID? And Dr. Barnes, I know you just spoke, but I'm going to start with you because, mm-hmm. you know, obviously student safety, faculty safety, these are key issues, top of mind issues for any institution. I don't think that that's really a debatable point. Mm-hmm. Beyond those issues, and we'll talk a little bit about those, but beyond the issues of student and faculty safety, what are some of the other key things that you're trying to keep in mind as Cleary moves towards reopening?
Besides student and faculty safety.
Yeah, I wanted to take that. I mean, that's the biggest one. That's the elephant in the room. Let's take that out of the equation for a second, because we're going to deal with that for sure. I wonder, aside from safety issues, because there are other, you know, associated things that I think any institution would have to keep in mind once that they feel that they have the safety down, because I don't think any institution would reopen if they didn't feel they could keep their faculty and their students safe. So beyond that issue, what is it that you and others at Cleary University are thinking about in terms of how do we proceed with the new normal?
Right. So I think that the key point to think about, and we'll go back to students. So if we take out student and faculty safety, as far as making sure that our day-to-day is safe for them to be there, it's going to be the student relationship. What are we doing to engage our students? How are we keeping the campus life alive and well and interactive? What are we doing to not only provide those critical services that they may need for physical comfort as well as emotional comfort, but also how are we having fun, right? How are we enjoying the campus environment? How are we putting those things in place that make being on a campus a campus, right? I think most of us have fond memories of what it was like to be on their college campus, attending college, going to classes, having fun with their friends, experiencing new things, the random jokes and dares and whatever it is on college campuses that happen in the middle of the night or on the weekend, and you know, they're all there. What are those things? And how are we working that and creating those opportunities now? So I think for me, it's still, aside from safety, it's going to be the student experience. And that comes from what they do every day on campus, how they are interacting with their professors online, on the ground, what type of communication and interaction they're having on a day-to-day basis, and how we're keeping that engagement there. I think for me, I mean, the students they're the pulse by far. Their well-being is essential, right? So we think about what are their critical needs. We keep their safety in place, we make sure their needs are met, then what? Right? So how are we giving them that college experience, and how are we still training them and giving them the education that we've promised so that they get what they want out of attending college and what they need at attending college? How are we still that place that we've always been for students? For me, that's top of my list.
So let's go maybe a little bit, go in a little bit higher focus. Maybe this question is best for Heather Bateman, Vice President and Dean of Student Affairs. As I mentioned before, obviously, you know, Clear University has a residential component with dorms. What does dorm life look like in the age of COVID?
Well, you know, we have, to Emily's point, we have taken the safety of our students as the number one priority, as well as our employees that work in those spaces. We're being creative with just social distancing, putting some safety guards in place. We've limited some room spaces. We have two students to a room for the fall. We also have created a safe space, if you want to call it a quarantine space. If there are any students that become ill or have any signs of illness, so we can provide them with a safe space to stay. We will remain open. That is ultimately our goal. We remained open this past spring. And there's definitely some changes that have been made, but we really want to provide some engaging student life events for them. I think that's important to keep our students engaged right now. It is, you know, athletics is a big part of our university as well. And so we're hoping to continue down that process and continue to keep our students engaged, but we have put some safety measures in place.
Have you been contacted by students concerned about how dorm life will work with just even their own concerns or issues, even beyond the safety measures, but even from the other angle that Dr. Barnes was talking about in terms of keeping that engagement? I mean, are there concerns from students that there's going to be so much safety protocols that what's the point of even being in a dorm?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think we're blessed with the fall, with the weather. We're going to try to do a lot of activities outside so we can have some social distancing and we can engage those students. That's a big one. You know, we have lobby spaces. We have created a safe space there with single seats versus couch type atmosphere. I think we can do some creative things. I know Matt Oliver's on too, who heads up that student life aspect, but we're being creative. We have a task force put into place to make sure that we can engage our students, and it's going to be different. You know, everybody's on, of course, Zoom right now and on their computers, and we have a hard enough time getting students out of their rooms to engage. And this will bring out hopefully some creative ideas. And we have a new director of housing. I believe she brings some expertise to us that will help with that. We have outdoor space. We have outdoor eating. One of the things we did change this past spring was a grab-and-go option for our food service. It's not a typical come sit down, eat all you want. That's a big change. But we will provide whatever is necessary for students. And it is a number one goal of ours to provide some services for them, even outside of student engagement. If it's mental health, if it's safety training, if it's COVID training, if it's just having a conversation. There's a lot of our professors that just get a phone call right now and have conversations with students because they need to talk to somebody. And I think if our staff can be there for our students, that's a different type of engagement. And I do believe we have such a great staff. Everybody is willing to pick up the phone and talk to any of our students at any time.
Okay, great. And Heather, maybe we'll circle back around to you at some point. I'd like to talk about things like, and this is farther down the road, so, you know, interesting in terms of things like commencement and other activities like that, which are surely on the calendar down the road. But I guess maybe it's a good point to maybe turn to enrollment, you know, in terms of trends and futures, enrollment issues, both COVID-related and otherwise. So maybe this question would be good for Dr. Banks or Dr. Banks Hall. I'm sorry, in terms of how the COVID shutdown and then combined with our, you know, recent societal upheaval, has that affected enrollment?
I believe enrollment for Cleary is holding steady, and looking at our programs, when you look at enrollment, it's about looking at the needs of what people actually want. So if I'm displaced, if my industry has closed, in our marketing, that's how we are reaching out, especially to those that are in looking for a graduate degree. How can this degree help you transform? And the reason why that is so important, because I was a product of that myself, having to leave an industry and restart over. And so as we are encouraging students to look at education, to look how it's going to help them for the future, the jobs and trends that are coming for the future. So at Cleary, we're reaching out, and David Hayes will be able to jump in, even with the undergrad program. We'll be reaching out for me to current students who have just completed their degree at Cleary, their undergrad, and they possibly want an undergraduate degree. And we're also reaching out to organizations and creating those types of partnerships, sharing what we actually have as they look at their workforce and see that there's some skill sets that need to be improved. And so now, for an economy that is on the rebound, you know, seeing how education can help you, can benefit you, when the program is promoted and given to you and you see that there is a benefit for yourself.
Do you, so Dr. Banks, also, do you feel that, or which effects, I guess, do you feel are temporary related to strictly the pandemic that will hopefully pass, and those that might become more temporary? I mean, I think that the educational landscape sort of shifted with everybody having to go online, you know, being forced to do it. You at Cleary, I know Cleary's had a pretty active online component, so it might have been easier for you guys than others. But what do you think is temporary, and what do you think is going to be more of a shift in how we look at education?
I think education for online, for working adults or people that need or have a desire to start over, will increase. We're looking at other, how we connect to other groups of people. I think for the traditional student, they will still want that campus experience. And so we actually do have that in place. So as I look at graduate programs, it's the working adult, it's the person that needs to start over, and the online environment, because of a Zoom sessions that we can now add that virtual meeting within the classroom. So you can still connect with your professor in the classroom. We can use collaborative tools and allow students, especially if they're working adults, they have a different experience. And so that being able to engage in a discussion with someone to go back and forth. A good example that I can give you, in a class that I just ended teaching this last week, students had to create a video of something that they are going to present and receive feedback from their classmates. So they had to schedule the time and discuss it and provide meaningful feedback. And the reason why it's so important, because each of those students are going to defend something that they are working on. And so they enjoyed, you know, that type of experience. So within the online environment, we can create opportunities for students. And so it's really about looking at the customer and determining, if I am a traditional student, I want that online campus experience possibly. If I am a single parent or working adult, then I may need online, because that allows me flexibility as it relates to education. And some of the things our instructors to do here at Cleary: announcements, weekly videos. We encourage them to narrate a PowerPoint. And so because they are experts, we are encouraging them to share their expertise. And so because we do that, that allows us to make sure that for us, even for working adults or those that are looking at their MBA as a type of career tool, that we're still giving them that experience because they are not on campus, but we're still able to engage them. And so I believe that as more people begin to look at their careers and where they are, depending on industry, they will make that determination to decide that online education is important. And I believe because of COVID, that this creates an opportunity for us to reach out to those groups that, because we're here in Michigan and maybe they're in Texas, they may not have looked at us, but now we have an opportunity to reach out to them.
Okay.
I jump in really quickly from just to add on to what Regina said, from more of an undergraduate experience and the role of the university in a community. It's really the job of a university within a community to assess the needs and then fill the needs not only of students or of the industries that they provide the degrees from, but for the community in general. And one of the big shifts that we've seen with COVID has been the move to people working remotely, for example. A great many people were laid off, of course, but also a great many people needed to learn some technological skills very quickly. And I think that's something that Cleary and other institutions bring to the table, is reacting to those needs of the community and filling those needs. So when we talk about what students will need permanently, there could be a permanent shift here to more remote work. We've proven as a nation that we can get things done without filling up our offices and our warehouses. So that's one of the things that we really like to highlight here, is that the dedication to not only what our students need, but as really the change leaders in the communities themselves.
So, David Hayes, again, Dean of Undergraduate Studies, see students as they come into the university environment, probably for the first time, a lot of students coming into this. What is it that how would you advise students and parents? Because especially those students that are new to the university environment, they're probably getting a lot of help from parents. Parents are trying to guide their students to the right institution, to the right course of study. What do you advise that they be looking for, and what role should parents be taking? I mean, this is a point where kids are supposed to sort of branch off and kind of, you know, grow their wings and fly on their own. At what point do parents need to let go?
Wow. This is all the parents, this is the hard news that anyone has to listen to. But to start off with, I oversee a lot of first-time college students. I am in front of the freshmen and the sophomores and the juniors and seniors all day long. And when they come in, for a couple of different reasons, there's sometimes an unreasonable expectation of what college is. And any of us that have, you know, been to the movie theaters in the past 30 years may have that same unreasonable expectation of what college is. But when they do arrive, I think that really the thing that stands out the most is the new adventure, the wide-eyed look at this is a whole new world. And, you know, we're seeing, because we did in the spring, we had to pivot pretty quickly when the first stay-at-home order started. And a lot of our students who were traditionally on campus went back home, and we started to do some remote learning through Zoom and our learning management system. And we started to see just how cabin feverish students would get being back home after this whole brand new life experience that they've just started into as freshmen. And so what we're looking at here is just really the ability for students to not be overwhelmed and realize that there's a support network outside of their families that they can trust in, because eventually they're going to be moving into some industry of their choice. Whether it be accounting or business management or my personal favorite, communications. Mm-hmm. And they'll realize that their support network will be not necessarily mom and dad anymore. And therein kind of lies the issue with, I don't know, what do we call that? Cutting the string, maybe. I think mm-hmm. that's a pleasant term. Parents, they need to be involved. They really do need to be involved in their students' lives, but they don't need to be involved in every single facet of their students' lives, mainly because your students who are now a freshman in college or they're coming back again and they're a sophomore, they're starting to develop their own ways of thinking, and not necessarily in terms of political ideologies or not necessarily in terms of how they see the world, but they're seeing things from an industry perspective now. They're all trying to decide where they're going to go in life and what fits with them. And the recommendation that I give parents most of the time is, please don't force your kids to choose a major when they're 18 or 17. Let them experience a couple of things first. You know, don't pre-plan that medical doctor program just yet. You know, you may have a budding actuary in your family and not even know it.
It is one of those things that maybe you or Heather Bateman maybe can answer this. Is how important is one of those things that they need to experience being failure?
Oh gosh. Yeah. 100%. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up because, and I don't mean to step on Heather, sorry, but I'm really passionate about failing because I think everyone needs to fail, of course, but it's not a case of where you need to fall down and then get beat up and then turned away. College and institutions of higher learning are a safe place to mess things up. If you're in class and you're trying something brand new, and it's brand new to you because it's school, and if you already knew it, you wouldn't have to be here. But it's brand new, and it's safe to mess things up in that class. It's really teaching students that failing is okay here, and the safety of this, you're learning how to do this for real in the real world. So take your time, take your bumps now, and get your processes down. Because you know, if it's too easy and someone just cruises through and they don't have to really try or apply themselves, they don't fail at anything. The first time they do fail when they get out will be catastrophic. And that's not the time to try things new. Try it new in the safety of your learning.
And so, Heather, let me follow up with you on that same issue. When it comes to failure, I mean, I guess, you know, I think that there's a common story, or at least my perception is there's a common story where you have students who excel in their high school environment. They're the smartest kid in the classroom, and they get to university and suddenly they're in a room of smart people. It's no longer, you know, the cruise control doesn't work anymore. How much have you found that to be an issue as well? And how do you deal with that?
Well, I think David had a good perspective on it. I think you're in a learning environment. I believe this is a great setting for failure. You know, I don't want to attribute to athletes, but they're the same way. They're the best in their high school. They come to Cleary University, and the best of the best is on the field with them. So if they're in the classroom or outside the classroom, they're going to fail. And it's just the nature, and they have to be willing to fail. I think that's an important piece of it. That's an important part of learning and growing up.
Right. And I'm
sure Dr. Barnes, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say a big part of this is emotional fortitude. And we've uniquely designed the curriculum to have a large component of trial and error and bringing in that. So you hear all the time people say, well, we got to teach creative thinking and critical thinking skills and how to problem solve and how to communicate and blah, blah, blah. All these things are skills. And to form skills, it takes a lot of time and repetition. That's just what a skill is. It's not content, right? It's easy to learn content. If that's the only thing we need to do, it'd be a piece of cake. But when you have to acquire a skill, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of repetition, and there's going to ultimately always be failure. And when it comes to innovating and bringing creativity to the new world, they have to be comfortable with failure. And I think it's a little bit of frustration tolerance that must be developed, because we don't have a lot of that. There's not a lot of individuals who spend a ton of time tinkering, practicing, playing, working it out, and then, you know, experiencing the whole frustration piece where they now have this endurance to keep trying and this endurance to pick themselves back up and this endurance to keep going at it even though they failed multiple times. So we're missing that piece. I think emotional fortitude overall, with being comfortable with high levels of emotion and low. So even be able to handle disappointment, and that could be associated with so many things. That could be failing at, you know, classwork for the first time, or hearing a perspective and seeing living proof of a perspective you've never seen before, and then realizing that something that you once believed isn't true. And once you, something that you thought was real isn't. And that can be emotionally distressing as well. So even in terms of having your worldview awakened, seeing, hearing something your entire life, and then you go to a place where now people, there's so many dynamic people around you, that you have not found evidence of what you've been told to fear, what you've been told to believe, what you've been told to know your entire life. So college can be a rude awakening that's also very positive at the same time. And what we've done, and we've embraced this, is this sense of growth, right? So it should be a safe place for students to fail ultimately fail a lot, right? And have that safe place to learn. It's hard, especially with I think it's a generational. I think it's also relates directly to athlete. You know, it's win or lose. So then to take the win or lose mindset, especially the one that we have here in America, you're either perfect or you're not. You know, you've either done it all the way or you haven't, or you either have money or you don't, or you've either had, you know, there's this whole in between though that we've forgotten, which is part of what makes power and intelligence and knowing.
Right. So I think we wanted to emphasize that we're talking failure with a small F and not a capital F. Right. I'm sure you didn't want the conversation to turn too much to just, you know, talking about failure. But still an important component of the university setting, learning how to do that, you know, in a good way. And learn from that. So I just want to remind anyone that has joined us since we started, you are tuned into the Cleary University Higher Education in 2020 virtual town hall. I'm your moderator, John King from WHMI. And again, anybody that is tuned in that would like to have a question asked, please do so in the chat function. We'll be more than happy to ask those questions. Next, let's turn to Dr. Bennett. You know, coming off our discussion here, you know, traditionally economic hard times, we see an increase in higher ed enrollment. You know, people use when the marketplace and the business place isn't booming, and there's not, you know, great jobs to be had necessarily just by showing up. Sometimes folks look like this is a good time to maybe burnish the resume a little bit and add to what I can do. Do you think that's the case, you know, this time? And in what ways do you think that's different, that this time will be different than it was, say, back in 2008?
Well, one, thanks for having us, John. I think, you know, across this panel, you get a lot of distinguished leaders in their respective fields. And I think what we have found is just having the conversations, as Dr. Banks Hall mentioned earlier, it's really about, I use a lot of analogies to try to make the difficult simple. And if you think about higher ed, I've always used the analogy, a higher educational institution thrives when they have a diverse portfolio, right? So that includes traditional age students, that includes adult students, that includes graduate students, that includes robust philanthropy, and so that they're able to weather hard times. What I think you find now is you've had a buildup of organizations that maybe haven't had the real hard discussions about their internal training, their internal workforce development programs. You know, last year they just reported hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars companies spend on training. And you talk about diversification, we look at those and listen. So we're in a unique position where we're actually having conversations with organizations of all sizes and scopes. And we're really trying to, you know, listen twice as much to hear what their pain points are, or as Dr. Banks Hall said, what their gaps are. You know, under Dr. Barnes' leadership, we've crafted, and David and Regina, our Cleary Mind concept, which doesn't just apply to 18 to 21 year olds, but it applies to learners of all ages to help grow organizations, whatever the industry. So we've also found, as we've engaged the corporate climate, their number one pain point, and this is the question we continually ask, is what are your pain points and where are their gaps? The number one answer to a company is attracting and retaining talent. So those are things where we're working with organizations in those sectors to truly try to identify how we can enhance their opportunities. But even within their organizations, it's succession planning is a skill gap or a gap within the organization because they haven't had to worry about it. So there's always these ebbs and flows amidst that. And I think what, as Dr. Banks Hall mentioned as well, you know, you never really want to hitch all of your horses to one wagon, but the more you spread it out amongst industries, amongst organizations and things of that nature, you give yourself the best opportunity to have success, at least in higher ed that I've experienced. So it's all of the above. And we're finding that that's really the case. And we're engaging, for instance, David and his work and Regina's with the high schools in Livingston County. You know, that's one population with corporations that we're working with and so on and so forth. So there is no one size fits all. It's just about identifying how we can deliver. And I think where I'm very confident in our opportunities is we're willing to listen, put our academic egos aside, if you will, and really deliver to the customer. And that's a great opportunity for organizations to grow when you're willing to listen and innovate.
So, you know, you mentioned diversity being a value that I think, you know, businesses want, and certainly in their graduates, that they have a more varied perspective on the world. You know, Clery University is, you know, from my perspective, has tried to stake a claim as being a diversity leader in Livingston County. You know, when we're talking about the issue of diversity and how that relates to curriculum specifically, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, of course, we're in the midst of this worldwide pandemic. We're also seeing societal upheaval at the same time around the issue of racial injustice. You know, what ways has Clery, you know, addressed this topic as a university, but in curriculum as well? And how might it continue to do that in the future? I don't know if Dr. Barnes or Dr. Banks Hall, you'd like to take this question.
Well, so I think that you have to hear from a few of us. So, I mean, I'd love to hear, have David share what he discusses in our classrooms and what Dr. Banks Hall discusses in their classrooms and with among students and the one-on-one conversations that we have. And I think you're completely right. When it comes to our current landscape and what's going on this year and the 2020 we'll never forget, right? I think that you see this sense of civic uprising, right? And it's not due to unjust cause, right? And I think that it's causing questions, uncomfortable questions to come to the forefront more than it's done for a long time. And for educators and as a university, we have a wonderful social responsibility to respond to those uncomfortable questions and engage in those uncomfortable conversations, and it lights us all up because that's what we're here for. And I think that one of the things that I am deeply committed to is to not react, because now we're in, and I've said this to our leadership team before, but I don't want to react because, oh, now the media is we hear about it every day, and it's, and you know, there's lots of conversations about it, and it's alive today. It's been something that has been the norm in the lives of many of our students and our communities and our people across the United States, across the globe, since they were born, since their parents were born, and their grandparents have been born. And so, and then keep on going, right? This is not something that's new. And for me, I don't want to say, well, now we're going to react. We're going to put on this, you know, we're going to hit our button. What are we going to do right now? The question I asked this group was, what are we going to do every single day to go out of our way, be inconvenienced, and become uncomfortable so that we have a chance of changing this? What are we going to do every single day the next 5, 10, and 15 years to address this and give it that diligence that it requires so that we truly can change something? We can put out our response statements, our fly the banners, you know, we can do that. But how do we make a substantial, long, meaningful change that will create a true outcome? And we have taken that to so many levels. And we've had people question, you know, what are you doing in your classrooms? What do you do your curriculum? This is something that has been, it's not new. We hear about it more today, but that's where the reaction has to come out of it. Because I want this to be something that is, it's part of our everyday practice. What are we gonna do every single day to create a better community? So that perhaps maybe when my children who are 5 are not my age having this exact same conversation, what are we going to do to mitigate that? And I would love for you to hear from the deans here, what they address in their classrooms, what they put at the forefront of their conversations, because we want that to be part of what students also hear every single day. And Andrew is also here. He might have some good input.
You want to take it, Regina, and I'll follow up?
Okay, yes. For me, one of the things that I try to encourage in the classroom and with faculty is that everyone, we must find value in everyone. And so when you are, for individuals that are seeking a graduate degree, a leadership, they're looking at something that they're actually trying to do. And so to look at themselves as a leader. And so with leaders, you're empathetic and you're trying to create a team, I often like to use a servant leadership of others before yourself. And so within an organization, how can I make sure that I find value in everyone, whether they are male or female or young or old? Because if I am a nation, I need all of those people to help me execute that vision and that mission statement. And so at Cleary, we encourage those types of conversations. Through case studies that we're through current events, if there is an issue that's taking place in the news, let's talk about it. Let's engage in that conversation, even online. You know, what do you think about it? If you were in charge, how do you make the situation better? And so that is part of the way of actually, you know, dealing and managing those types of issues. For me, being a part of the Cleary team, coming out there and encouraging others to become a part and share their expertise. When we can find value in everyone, regardless of who they are, color, sex, whatever religion, then we can create a better workplace. From an economic standpoint, I tell students, if I am relocating to Michigan, I'm going to look at all of these different things and determine where my business, where I want to open a shop, because that's going to be important for me as a business owner, as a CEO. I want that diverse talent. And so for us, it's about leadership and helping you as a student who's moving into leadership, take on those principles and find value in people. And so it's one of the things that we encourage all the time. And I'll let David add his perspective on what takes place. I believe that overall, I think we've done an excellent job in making people see that they are leaders and that we're creating the future. And to Dr. Barnes' point, the future of our children, so that they know that we've created a better world for them. And so I turn it over to David now.
How do you follow a better world? That's such hard, that's such a hard thing to follow. If I'm going to tie a couple things together. So Dr. Bennett mentioned the Cleary Mind. That's our curriculum. It's fairly new. There was a big switch a couple of years ago that would really revitalize and revamped the curriculum that we have. And that's kind of, you know, the crux of what an institution of higher learning does. What's your curriculum? And that's the one thing that every student and every staff member and every faculty member sees every day. It's you're dealing with the curriculum and what you're learning and how you're learning. And when we talked about the safety zones in terms of failure, those safety zones have to extend to really difficult conversations. Our younger students, the freshmen and the sophomores, are going to be coming in from largely a homogeneous neighborhood or family where really everyone around you is a lot like you. And when you're put into a group like a university with a bunch of people that are not like you, there's going to be some differences in ideology. There's going to be differences in religion. There's going to be differences in how you do things. Talk to Heather about two people in a dorm room. There's differences in who does the dishes and how things are done. There's just differences that you haven't going to experience before. So invariably, living together, these conversations, these new difficult conversations are going to come up. Someone else's experience that's going to be 100% different from yours is going to come up. And we reiterate that in our classrooms too. So the idea of the Cleary Mind, there's a lot of problem solving and critical thinking and a lot of ethical thought that goes into it. But when we are directly in the classroom, and I love to have the freshmen every year in my communications class. And within that class, we talk about all kinds of different things, all kinds of difficult things. We talk about racial unrest. We talk about how world economics works. We talk about how advertising and media affect people. And they're conversations that normally don't happen in the students' daily lives prior to that. So when we're addressing that in this really safe space, wherein you're allowed to have your opinion, you know, you're allowed to have any opinion you have, as long as you can back it up with some real factual evidence or some real thought behind it. And as students really progress through the year, you see lights go on, you see minds change, you see people that have never, ever run into each other before from two completely different cultures form these wonderful bonds over dialogue that they never thought they would have. And that's really kind of the magic of higher learning in our classrooms, because those conversations, they have to have a safe place to do them. But once it's safe, then they can engage. And that's really kind of the high watermark that we've set for our student body.
So let me follow that up, and whoever wants to take this can, on this same issue when it comes to diversity. You know, how does Cleary stay relevant as a diversity leader when you are based in a county that's 93% white? And I guess in a way to sort of add on to that, in terms of you do draw students from all around. So, you know, what perspective, you know, like it or not, Livingston County has a reputation, and to the outside world. And so how much of that plays into folks who are looking at Cleary University and go, well, I don't know. Is that an issue that you find when you're talking with prospective students? And again, how much of the fact that the county just demographically is so homogenous, how does that inform Cleary's diversity stance?
So I can start this. I'd like to say that this is something that I believe must be part of leadership of any institution. It has to be part of everything that we do every single day. Our intention has to be set. We have to be committed, and not committed unless this or that, but truly committed to bringing that here. And there are instances where we do have hesitation, and we do have questions from incoming students about their safety with attending school in Livingston County. That is a norm that we experience. And it is also something that I would say we don't want to, if you ask a real question, we don't want to have that experience with our students. We don't want them to have to feel that way. We don't want that to occur. So there is so much dedication applied to changing that existence, that changing that mindset, changing that fear. And it's not fear based on falsehoods. It's not fear based on theories and folklore. It's not fear based off of stories and tales of long ago. It's fear based off of what happened last week and what happened a month before. And I think we have to be okay with that too, because we're not going to create the change that we need to create if we are avoiding the things that make us extremely uncomfortable and things that we don't want to talk about. And until we can manage to get those issues to the forefront, change is going to always be a slow and steady climb. So for us, we are highly intentional of breaking that discomfort and bringing that to the forefront. And what we have done and what we have put in place to make sure that we can provide that safety and that we can address those issues openly. I know that everyone here has had a different experience as far as listening and hearing students and their experience they've had in this area. Even with, for me, listening to staff and teachers who come to Livingston County who are from other areas of Detroit or other areas of Michigan, say from Detroit, who have had experiences as soon as they get near us, right, with how safe it is to go and what they might hear when they're waiting in line at the gas station to pay for their fuel or into a restaurant. And what the biggest mistake we could make would be to ignore that and pretend like that's not real. And that was something that was in the past when it's not. That's something that happened last week. Okay.
So how much of that do you, you know, beyond the Cleary, you know, campus and the curriculum, just being an institution within Livingston County, how much do you try and advance that narrative to other leaders in the county, political and civic service and otherwise, who maybe do still have, I think, an attitude of that's in the past and that's not us now. But yet you probably more than any other institution or organization do see on a continuing basis the fact that that is still a issue. This is an issue still.
Right. So I think bringing those conversations to the forefront and not batting them away. I think that's one of the biggest issues, is being comfortable with conflict and not the anger, danger conflict, but conversations that need to be had. Approaching reality face to face, right? Instead of something that we've pushed away, right? And I am deeply committed. I know that Cleary University depends upon dynamic minds and dynamic experiences and dynamic people. We depend on everybody. We are highly dedicated to providing and creating inclusivity. We've updated our mission and vision this year. It is something we are committed to being student-centered. We are committed to being an inclusive world, to bring that globalization to us. We are committed to doing that. So even with our events, our conversations, our topics, things that we have done, is an effort to bring these conversations to light, because I think that's where it starts. It starts in your family home. It starts among your friends, your circle of friends. It starts in the car on the way to the grocery store. That's where these conversations start. And we have to get to a place where it is so uncomfortable, where there's no one else to find. There's no one to have this conversation with, because it's so taboo and it's so against the grain, that we are no longer perpetuating a cycle of racism in multiple families or generations of families, where crude behavior or comments or aggression or microaggressions is no longer acceptable. So much so that it's shameful. It's hard to find your population to speak to. I do believe that's something that must happen. I know that we have students who come here and on a tour, and their parents are so concerned with their safety that they reach out to whoever they can find comfort in to ask if their child will be safe here in Livingston County. Or when I have staff who make sure that they don't want to stop in the city because they don't want to have any negative interactions while they're here getting gas or getting a burrito. So they'll avoid that. Or even the idea of bringing somebody in who, for recruiting, we'll send them out to have engaged different groups and that kind of thing, and they're worried about their safety with where they'll be welcomed. And I know there's been so many, I just don't want to shy from this. I think I could give you every PC answer I could. And I think that's just taking us right back, shying away from what the real conversation has to be. And I'm okay with that discomfort and that friction, because I believe that's how change happens. So I'm more than happy with anybody here for them to share what they've encountered with our students and the stories and even personal interactions. But for me at Cleary, it is my utmost intention to make sure that I move the needle in that area. Because I feel like if a leader, if you're in a role where you have such a strong presence and you have a leadership role where you're able to make that much impact, then you should use it, right, to create a betterment for all. And if you haven't, then you've wasted your time a little bit. So feel free, anyone else to provide.
I think for me, being African-American, working in Livingston County, that it's important to understand the past and understand the issues that surround all of that. To Dr. Barnes' point, that it can be a tough conversation. But if I look down the road of when I go back to thinking about the next generation and the generation that's coming after them, then I have to say, well, how does Livingston County want to be viewed in the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years? Do we still want to be talking about this issue? And so part of it in talking to parents that have those concerns, and I've had conversations with parents, I say, yes, I do understand the concerns. I understand that concern for myself, but we have to be part of the change. And I do believe that is important. And so it is going to require someone to be brave enough to take that step, to go out. It's also important to partner with in the community, and so that they know that we're here. And so I've reached out to the chamber, the Livingston Diversity Council, to have those types of conversations and to build those different types of relationships. And so, over time, reaching out, letting the sheriff know, who I am, all of those things over time can be important tools as the community addresses those issues and begin to bring about change. And so for a parent, yes, there are some history issues, and you should be aware of that, but your child is here to get an education and become a productive part of a citizen. And so this journey of theirs can be used in the chapter that they will write as they talk about their life. You know, I came, I participated, and this is what I learned, and I'm able to actually, you know, move forward. And so I think it's two, embracing the tough conversation, but then also, okay, how can the community open up and show that we are embracing people? Because as a university, we are a leader, and so we can be the example that shows everybody else, this is how you get it done, because this is what we've done here. And so that's my part in adding to that.
And okay. Just to add on a little bit, we are, everyone, I think this, it's not lip service either. And I think that every faculty member, staff member, employee, and student, if I could speak for all the students at Clear University, really embraces diversity and inclusion as an ideology, as a thing that's really important. And I know that, you know, all the panelists on this call and some of the faculty members that have joined in, are, you know, on different boards in the community, different organizations, and I know that it isn't simply, you know, in the confines of the campus where this is important. This is how Clear University Cougars live, and it's really an important factor and an important facet of what we do. That's the kind of change agent that I think a university should be within a community.
Okay. So we're coming into our last half hour here of our town hall. Again, this is Clear University Higher Education in 2020 virtual town hall. And so I want to switch gears a little bit and go back to some more practical aspects talking about higher education and specifically curriculum and or more to the point about just how you're going to handle curriculum in an age of COVID. So the governor has laid out a plan for Michigan public schools, basically saying they need to have three plans ready. Things are in flux when it comes to COVID-19. One is to be fully remote, as we ended the last year. Another is to have a plan that can do mixed. So maybe students are in class some days and remote the other days. And another plan, should things go in a best case scenario, that they could have more in-class experience and have more flexibility, I guess. So where does Clary stand in terms of, planning? I'm assuming that you're trying to remain flexible as well with the plans that you're going to have, depending on the circumstances.
So I'm happy to also chime in here. It's fun to be the president and the provost, because I get to talk about a lot of things. But with our class structure, so we are planning on yes and, okay? So similar to what we did in the spring, there was a reason why we had a smooth transition to fully online. All of our courses are built to leverage both environments. So it's a high inclusivity model of education. So every ground class is built online, and there's always a piece of interaction. So as we have, so let's say there's an in-person class, that in-person class has multiple components that already are online, and it's consistent with online, so much so that our goal was, and this is what our model was, is that anybody who was taking an on-ground class or an online class could say, I'm in town this week, or I want to go to class and talk to my professor, and they could easily float from online to in-person, and all the students are still on the exact same page. They haven't missed a beat. So we call that multi-format, where they can be in person one week, they can choose to be online next week, and the learning experience is fluid for all. And so that's our high inclusivity model. More so, there is, and we call it the flip class. Some people call it the flip classroom. Some people call it the, having the active learning on ground with receiving some of your content online. So all the content we provide in an online setting, and we may go through that in a different way on ground, activities on ground, interaction on ground, but we also leverage that interactivity and those activities online with the same group of students. Because you might have a student who's attending your classroom and may be on ground with you 1 week and be online for 2 weeks and then back on ground the week after. And that's such a normal model for us, because we wanted to provide that flexibility for our students. So when it came time to going all online, it was a switch, just saying, okay, by the way, we're just going to finish this class online now. There wasn't a lot of restructuring and redesigning because we had already planned it to be that way. We've already planned it to accommodate every student equally, instead of having the comparison between the on-ground and the online class, right? People have their preferences, but we wanted to have as much equity in learning as we could from the very beginning. And we've leveraged this model now for 18 months, 2 years. So with going into the fall, we'll be doing the exact same thing, is having that flexibility. So we have that multi-format model where students can choose how they attend. They'll attend on ground, especially during their first year, 2 years, unless we need to shift back to the online format. But majority of our students float anyway. We have athletes, they're very busy. We have students who work, we have students who travel, commute. We have students who have internships and many different demands. So because of that, we love this model. And with this year with COVID, I think that flexibility in the hands of students will become ever more important. And we're already prepared for that.
So flexibility, of course, is important, but also getting some answers. We do have a question from somebody in the audience to this very point. They ask, how soon before move into dorms would a fully remote decision be made if necessary? And they point out that they live in Canada. So you want to be flexible, but on the other hand, people need, you know, answers. How do you handle both of those?
Got it. So before, as far as this fall, so we have move-in scheduled already for August
24th. August 22nd. 22nd is move-in. We start class on August 24th, that Monday.
Mm-hmm. The likelihood that unless we see, and this is what I'll say, unless we see a dramatic shift as far as what we are allowed and mandated to do between now and August 24th, the shift to fully remote is not likely to occur. It's not something that will be a whim. It won't be a change. It just comes because of, you know, this is what we want to do. It'll be if the state of Michigan is in a state of higher education may not operate, that's when we will go fully remote. Just similar to what we did in the spring, we did not go fully online until we had to. So that opportunity will be there for students to come in person and to move in as usual for the fall.
And even at that point, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, you have some international students. You had some students that stayed on campus even when the state was at its stay-at-home order.
Yeah, we had a group of students that stayed until the semester ended. You know, housing was fully operational. We had staff in place responding to any of their needs. We had food service in place. We did receive a lot of questions with closing of housing, but closing we did not do. We don't anticipate that once our students are on campus. Our goal would be to remain open for our housing units and to keep our students safe and healthy within those spaces.
So the chance that we will mandate students to leave is extremely unlikely. So we didn't do that in the spring. Students, that's their home. We treated it like it's their home. So students were able to stay. If they chose to leave, then they chose to leave. But no student will have to leave unless we get, again, unless we get shut down by the Department of Health or if we get told that we may not have housing at a government intervention, we would not shut down housing.
You know, there was a headline late this afternoon. I don't know if you're, you know, aware of it. It somewhat pertains to this, but ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, announcing this afternoon, foreign students whose schools operate online only this fall will need to transfer to institutions or they'll leave the country. They could face deportation proceedings. So I know that your international students is a pretty small contingent. But as you, what I'm hearing is that the likelihood that this would even apply is pretty remote for Clary University.
Oh, yeah. So as far as full remote learning, it would be a government intervention. Mm-hmm. As far as we're concerned, it's not something that we would do on a whim by any means. So even with our international students, so it is a requirement they attend classes on ground. We are looking forward to having our international students return in the fall, and especially with all the things up in the air as far as visas and what we're able to do. As of right now, we know that having on-ground classes is critical for those students to come back to their university this fall. And that's something that we're completely committed to having now. Again, the only issue would be if we are mandated to close or to stop or to go online.
So, and I guess the flexibility that you were speaking about before in terms of having the, you know, whether it's remote or on ground, you know, having that flexibility, it sounds to me as if that served you well in this instance. Mm-hmm. You know, being they gave you the flexibility that maybe other institutions did not have. I know, you know, for my own, you know, student, you know, I've got I had a sixth grader who suddenly was doing all her classes online and did not thrive in that environment. Now, obviously, that's not a higher education issue, but the same thing somewhat applies, I guess, in terms of how much of this. This kind of flexibility, this being able to transition from remote to in-ground, on-ground classrooms, that this is really the model of what future of higher education is looking like. Those institutions that are quicker to adapt to it are probably going to be the ones that stay more vibrant.
So I love this. It's my favorite question this year. I've heard this one a lot, actually, and I love it because for me, it's a direct workplace skills issue, right? So we talk about classes, but let's talk about workplace. So our job is to prepare them for work, right? And lo and behold, here we are, right? Doing this on this call on Zoom at, what is it, you know, 7:09 at night. And for us to prepare our students adequately for the workplace, we must also prepare them to work on global teams across state lines, across country lines. They will be doing that, obviously. When we had this question come up earlier before with a town hall with our students, one of the students said, what I do with students is highly engaging. It's in person. What do I do? And I say, well, welcome to the exact same question that everyone is asking themselves right now is, how do I do this knowing that I can't be in person? How do we do this knowing that we can't rely on our usual, you know, the most preferred method, the most practiced method? And that's a question that everyone across the globe is asking themselves right now. And innovating and coming up with new strategies through that is going to be critical. And it's critical to also teach our students to thrive in that environment because this is a normal. I even think back to my career, how much time I spent in a virtual environment working with teams across nations, and it was significant. So if that's not something I was trained to do in college, then I'm at a loss when I get to the real world. And these students are the same. So for us, it's so critical to make sure that they are working in teams across platforms, even between online and on ground. So you got students on ground, you got students online, they need to be working together. They don't have a different conversation because some are on ground and some are online. How do you bridge that gap, knowing that the people who you work with every day and the people who you interact with every day, they're going to be apart from you. There's not a lot of industry left where that's not a component as far as your success factors. So leveraging that technology to have that engagement, to build those communication gaps, essentially important. And to go back to, is this a new norm? I think that having that ultimate flexibility for us to sustain all shifts in our environment, right? Outside forces, having that adaptability is number one as far as transcending years and time in different obstacles, because how else do you stay ultimately adaptable when you don't know which way the wind will shift you? Not knowing what will happen with the amount of cases in Michigan or across the U.S., not knowing what the what our orders may be or what the landscape will truly look like. So because of that, I think that working in adaptability as a norm is going to equal success.
And so for students looking to, you know, provide them tools to be successful upon graduation, having this online capability is an important part of that. Do students see that now, or is it something that they come to embrace over time?
So I would say, as far as the classroom, but just look at every day. So is there a distinction now at all anyway? So if you ask, you might ask one professional if technology is critical to day-to-day every single activity, and they may still refer to it as enhancement or a tool that can be used, but there's still plenty to have without the technology. You might ask somebody else and there's no longer a distinction. So because there is still a comparison, right? So some people still have a comparison to what life was like pre and post technology. There was a time when there was less and less technology. Now there's more and more and more technology. So imagine 20 years from now, when there's not many people who can relate to that question anymore of technology or not, when it's just technology is yes. So one day that question will expire, because these kids have been born and there's not a division in technology and what they do every day and how they interact with the world every day and how they access information every day. So for one, a few years, and is that question something that just is gone now, because there is nobody left who can compare what it was like to not have technology.
So we've got about 15 or so minutes. I do want to switch to a different topic, one that is somewhat completely different from online, something that is very difficult to do online, and that's athletics. So these questions are for Heather. What sports at Cleary look like for both athletes and for spectators here in the fall?
For sure. We have a governing body with the WAC, which is our conference, and the NAIA, which is the national governing body. So some of our guidelines are coming from those organizations right now. We have a limited number of, for fall, soccer is, men and women's soccer is in session. We have reduced that game schedule. And we also have reduced our meet schedule for cross country. One of the things we're going to focus on also is our out-of-season teams that can compete. So, for example, baseball and softball, they do have fall ball. And we're going to focus on their health and safety. And they are not going to be allowed to have any competition on campus or off campus. We're going to limit their travel. One of the things specifically with athletics is travel. How do we travel in social distance? How do we keep our students safe? Our athletic training association, they have given us specific guidelines for participation. Temperature testing, not officials, but game administrators and folks like doing the scoreboard will be asked to wear masks, and going through the line and shaking hands after a game won't happen. Sanitizing game balls when we can. The guideline hasn't come through yet, but we do anticipate not having fans, which is a big one, which basically would mean we would try to figure out how to live stream games and just so fans and families could at least watch the competition. Our league is unique. We have teams in Ohio and Indiana, and their state guidelines are different than ours. So that is something that our league, our athletic directors are trying to come up with a solution to really help support the engagement. It's a huge student engagement on our campus and all these campuses for smaller schools of our size. And so we're worried about that, making sure that we obviously maintain enrollment with our student athletes, but also give them a good season, something to look forward to, being productive. And they need it. They really need it. They need to get involved. They need to have some time with their teammates and their coaches. And there are some specific guidelines. Those are just some of those, but we are still trying to tackle some of the questions with the fans and how we can support that.
Have you had to, and this is more of a rhetorical question because I imagine the answer is yes, but I guess maybe it's better asked, how have you had to adapt in terms of recruiting athletes? Especially when you said like there's other states that have, recruiting athletes, for scholarships, other states that maybe have lesser mandates might be more attractive to the athletes.
Well, and I can use baseball and softball as a great example. We have a wonderful stadium on our campus, And our stadium is currently closed to outside guests. We are not allowing tournaments, camps, anything on that field. And that was a huge recruiting tool for us. Some schools in our state specifically are not allowing coaches to travel outside of the state to recruit. Indiana and Ohio are having softball and baseball leagues right now. So our coaches are traveling to other states to recruit. Michigan is not. Most schools in Michigan are not allowing these tournaments to take place. And so it is hindering how we recruit. Clary University just recently reopened our doors so guests could come on campus for a limited time. And so we just started having campus visits again. We had student athletes that signed with us in January and still did not sign their scholarship letter. So they've been doing that a lot lately to get those great pictures and get it, you know, mom and dad. I've had the opportunity to meet a lot of recruits recently who finally did get to come to campus to check it out. And so that it's difficult. It is, I've been on Zooms with coaches discussing all of this. Currently, I know we haven't touched base on this, but we have our orientations that we normally do on campus with all our students. They're all online. We have three of them. We'll have another one in August, and it's different. It's long, it's tasking. We try to engage the students as much as we can, of course, but it is difficult.
Are you still offering scholarships?
Yes. Yes. We do have athletic scholarships. We have academic scholarships. And so we really focus on institutional aid and focus on what our student athletes can receive and those kind of things. I have a 6-year-old talking to me. Sorry. I'll be there in a minute.
Do they have a question?
Do you have a question? Yes. So, you know, it's difficult. It's time, you know, but our students that we're recruiting, they're used to it because most institutions we're at a level playing field right now, if you want to say that. And so that helps. That definitely helps with recruiting. And we do definitely have athletic scholarships. In our teams aren't full yet. It has been very difficult for some of our teams to recruit. I'll use our men's ice hockey program, for example. When everything got shut down, ice hockey arenas were shut down. So any ability that our coaches could go recruit seniors in high school, that was eliminated immediately. So it's making it difficult for some specific teams.
And that must have been particularly difficult because those programs you were just trying to get up on their legs and get going.
Yes, it is. And as you know, in the spring, all our spring sports were canceled across the state. And so we're thankful that most of those seniors are allowed to come back and participate again. We have lost some of them to graduation, which is a good thing. And we're grateful that some of them are coming back. I see that smile, David. But, you know, again, we're just kind of going day to day. Our leadership team has created daily plans that the next day we've had to scrap and start all over. I think that's been the most frustrating aspect of all of this.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that aspect on athletics. Mm-hmm. And I'll use an athletic metaphor to kind of transition here. I'm going to make an audible here at the line. And I see that Andrew Chamberlain is logged in, and if I'm not mistaken, Andrew, you're in charge of counseling.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So I think that's interesting, from Clary University is typically, or at least, you know, in the past or traditionally, you know, Clary University, it's a business school. In terms of, obviously, you know, Clary has made a clear turn, towards a full breadth university environment, providing student counseling a big part of that. How busy are you?
Yeah, it's been busy to a differing degree throughout all of last year. I think last year felt like a lot of real triage work, real quick kind of assessment work, to really just get in sort of the discomfort, the conflict, as Emily mentioned, to just be in those places with them. But it was often sort of short-term solution kind of focused work with them to kind of get them quickly back on their feet and help them keep moving forward. It was less kind of treatment oriented so far, but and more so just really being with them. It felt like being a coach at times, just really encouraging, supporting, letting them know. One of the things I think I say a lot as part of our team is that we're going to try and do as many things in relationship with people, but certainly with the students. So when there's disappointment, when there's concern about race and me as a student of color coming to Howell, we're going to have that conversation, be in that discomfort, and be together. We're not going to do it from a distance, do it with an email. We are going to be in the midst of that experience of being human.
Do you find that students are surprised that you're there? I mean, how do you let your presence be known, I guess?
Yeah, well, I get to have another hat on. I get to do a little bit of teaching and be part of Welcome Week. And so let them hear from me, see me. And then some of those students that get to have class with me, sometimes they say class feels a little bit like therapy, and I take that as a compliment and yet try and challenge myself to kind of make sure I be careful with that hat. But it gives a real chance for me to let them see a pretty, I'm not normal, but I'm a, I'm a Pinckney grad, you know, Livingston County's in my blood. I'm not a blank slate. I don't sit with a clipboard. I get to sort of level stigma, you know, with mental health, and just help them see that we as professors, as faculty, as staff, we're embodied humans as well in this work and in this complexity.
And Andrea, you can answer this or anyone else, I guess, in terms of the whole student approach. I mean, we've talked about curriculum, we've talked about faculty, we've talked about student life, you know, dorm rooms and things like that, and all the different aspects of that. But the whole student notion of how successful can a student be if they are not comfortable in their own skin, if they're experiencing sort of, mental issues, not mental issues per se, but I'm just, you know, basically a mental crisis, a crisis amongst themselves. How much does that fit in, and how new is that to education to factor that in to the approach?
Well, and then maybe Emily or David or Dr. Jim Akes Hall can answer that a little bit more, but I think on one hand, I think it's one of the more important things that our students will take with them is the ability to understand themselves, see themselves honestly, and let someone else see them honestly and be in that sense present to them, letting them know, I see who you are. Even when there's failure, I see failure and I'm not going to disconnect from you. A lot of us have had experiences in life where there was moments where there was emotion, moments where there was failure, and it meant disconnecting relationally. That's different, I think, in many ways with this collection of people. And maybe, I don't know if one of you want to share a little bit more about the importance of that element in higher ed.
Well, so, I mean, and I think there's several of us that can say this, but I've been in this long enough, year after year after year, a freshman, right? I've got to see the evolution live with my own eyes, and it's not anything new. I can recall 10, 13 years ago, seeing for the first time curriculum brought in about emotional growth and how it's a barrier to things like time management and things that are become barriers to success, simple things, but where bias, values, emotional stability, emotional health, physical health, how that really impacts your ability to thrive and be successful. And it was always something that I believe was refreshing because it's taking in this idea that we're a human being, not just a machine here to learn, right? But it's evolved over time. It's evolved differently depending on where you go and who you're having conversation with. And I think that from my purview, from my experience watching, you know, freshman group after freshman group after freshman group, and I know that anybody can speak to this, most of us on the call can speak to this. There has been, though, a shift, a paradigm shift as far as just acknowledging and awareness. It's not anything that I would say is completely new, as much as it is now we're responding differently to it. Instead of saying, well, you know, oh, you're 18 now, it's time for you to get out of the nest, you know, it's time for you to, you know, pull up the bootstraps and walk, whatever people say. It's more of a, this is real, this is something that we know that we're experiencing, and we know that if we can work and address and be, like Andrew says, in relationship with these students, that not only will we provide them with what they need for their internal growth at this point, but then they're in a better place to receive the intellectual growth and the professional growth as well. And as far as looking at the needs of a student, it's very simple. I mean, you have a kid who is hungry, they're less likely to pay attention. If they haven't slept, if they're in distress, if they're suffering, they're not going to be at a place to learn. Even with this spring, past spring semester, putting things in place so that we were accommodating students in a way we'd never done before. Because when a student doesn't have Wi-Fi at home, they live on a farm in the middle of rural Michigan, and they are now parked in the parking lot of McDonald's that they can't even go into, and they have no money to get a burger, and they're trying to do their homework on an iPhone with a cracked screen in the parking lot of a McDonald's to get their free Wi-Fi, that is not an environment that is conducive to optimal learning. It can be done, but that's not the best. So how are we now addressing those types of situations, but also how are we helping mend from within so that the student is prepared mentally to learn? And we're finding that when we take that approach, the student has a completely different experience as far as learning in a classroom. So Andrew, I know Andrew and Adam both could speak to Days about that, but it's even the mindset of the instructor being more of a, okay, we're gonna lean into this instead of get over this.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think has been the biggest shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Good, Regina.
I was gonna say flexibility is from the instructor perspective, and recognizing, paying attention to who's in the classroom, recognizing there's an issue possibly, and then working with them to help steer them to the right path. If they need to talk to Andrew, well, here's somebody that I recommend that you talk to. And so those are some of the things that we encourage by paying attention to where there is something going on, and then directing them to the right person that can actually help them. Maybe they just need just to spend 5 minutes talking to you about whatever is going on in their life. And so we create that environment on campus so they feel comfortable. And so we tell them our doors are open, and so you can stop by to actually have that conversation. So part of that, whether it's an undergrad student that wants to talk to me or a graduate student that wants to talk to David, we just, it's an open door policy as it relates to students. And by doing that, we create an environment for them to see that they recognize that we care and that we're all here to actually help them.
I think the term is truly being student-centered, not instructor-centered or curriculum-centered, but student-centered. And I think in the past it wasn't that it wasn't there. I do not believe it's anything new. I've seen it myself. It's how we approach it, how we are addressing these needs with our students, and having that student-centered environment is a big critical piece.
All right. Well, we've reached the end of our hour and a half. Obviously, a lot more that we talk about, but I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. I do want to thank everyone for participating. Our guests tonight, Erie University's interim president and provost, Dr. Barnes, Dr. Matt Bennett, Senior Vice President of Institutional Advancement, Heather Bateman, the Vice President and Dean of Student Affairs, Dr. Regina Banks Hall, the Dean of Graduate and Professional Studies, David Hayes, the Dean of Undergraduate Studies, and Andrew Chamberlain with Council Services. I do want to let everyone know a recording of this town hall will be made available. We're going to put that on our website, whmi.com, in the podcast section. You will find it there. Again, I want to thank everyone for taking part in our town hall meeting tonight. I'm John King. I want to thank you for watching. Have a great evening and an even better tomorrow. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.